Hey everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. It is August, my dudes, and we're going to talk about August movies this week. I am Neil Pollack. I am your host. I am the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. I am the current editor-in-chief of Arizona Globe. All the Globes, all the time. And this week, I'm also hosting the podcast. I always host the podcast. I'm the only person. Not the only person who's ever hosted the podcast. I've had guest hosts, but I'm mostly, most of the time, the host of this podcast. First, we're going to talk to contributor Stephen Garrett about two new movies. One is called One Night Only. It's kind of a strange dystopian rom-com sex farce that is in theaters now. And I'm also going to talk to Stephen about The End of Oak Street, which is an early 80s style suburban dinosaur thriller. I know, a genre that you can't get enough of. Stephen and I will talk about those in a little bit. And I'm also going to talk to contributor Laura Pruden about Tony, a excellent coming-of-age biopic, believe it or not, about Anthony Bourdain, set in the summer of 1975 on Cape Cod. Great, great film. I can't wait for you to hear more and I talk about it. But first, Stephen Garrett is here, as always, to talk about a couple of new movies. And we'll be right back after this interesting thing. We've reached the one night a year where Stephen Garrett and I talk about movies. We have 12 hours to talk about movies, and then the government is no longer going to allow us to talk. Actually, that's not true, Stephen. We talk about movies a lot, and not always at night.
That's true.
During the day.
That's true. But this is also when we talk about August movies, which are also their own category.
Yeah, it's August movie season, and this is the August movie episode of
Dog Days of Summer.
It's kind of my favorite time for movies because these are movies these are oddball leftover movies that, you know, aren't blockbuster, summer blockbuster material, and they're also by far and away not the Oscar bait material that you start seeing in the fall. This is just kind of extra stuff that the studios had left over, and the first movie we're going to talk about is a science fiction dystopian romantic comedy called One Night Only.
Wait a minute. Okay, I was about to say. I was like, which one of these? No. They're both kind of
right,
bad.
But first we're going to talk about One Night Only, which I think is in some ways a more interesting film than the other one we're going to talk about.
Certainly a sexier.
Well, and here's the thing about, okay, so One Night Only is the premise is the ridiculous premise that is hardly explained is that somehow the government has managed to mandate that single people are only allowed to have sex for 12 hours a day once a year, one night. They get from like 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. during what appears to be in the summer, because like it gets light, it stays light late.
August 7th. No, they say in the movie it's August 7th, which is actually the day that the film gets released. Actually, no, I'm sorry, it's July. Wait, what?
It's the summer.
I think it's July 7th, so it's 7-7 at 7 p.m.
Okay, so there's a lot of daylight. It's only dark for about half the movie. It's an absurd premise and makes no sense, and the movie's politics are all over the place. But, you know, it's funny, Stephen. The complaint I heard about One Night Only was that there's no sex in this movie about sex. And I'm like, and I watched it today as we're talking. I was like, there's a ton of sex in it.
There's a ton of off-screen.
Yeah, I mean, yes. Is there just like non-stop? It's not a porn. It's, you know, a porno. It's a sex comedy. But there's lots of people making out. I mean, you know, there's like, you know, lots of people taking off their shirts and stuff. And our two main characters almost have sex numerous times with various people throughout the course of the film. So I don't see what they're talking about. Like, there's lots of implied sex. You see LeVar Burton and Molly Ringwald wrapped in bubble wrap.
I mean, God bless, right? They got the middle-aged sex, you know, represented. Yeah. I appreciate that. And I guess the bubble wrap kink community.
I think they're just trying something.
Good on them.
They're just trying something out. Why not? You know, that's how you want to spend your one night only. Yeah. You know, so the premise is stupid.
It's pretty dumb. But you know what? I think two things. I think the premise is trying to find a novel way of doing a romantic comedy by creating, you know, romantic comedies generally have to have some sort of
twist,
block, yeah. or twist, certainly, but something that keeps the two lovers or two protagonists from becoming yes. lovers, right? Like there needs to be, a, as they say in the movie, like a cock block or a titty block yeah. or whatever.
There are
right?
lots of them. There's lots of.
And there lots of them, including like trying to find a condom, which is mysteriously mandated by the government as well, you know. So that there are a lot of contrivances that keep these two people from getting it on. But what they're trying to say also is that, you know, the hottest sex is the sex that you have to wait for, right?
Yeah.
You know, to a certain extent. Or another way of saying that is you really need to get to know somebody before you really have meaningful sex.
Right.
Which, you know, is debatable, but sure.
I mean,
you know, and certainly that's what romantic comedy
is. Yeah, I think it's fine. It's not like a particularly right-wing idea to say that. You know, it's a, you know, and no. It's not saying that, you know, they're saying, I think it says that sex can be good and pleasurable without affection and romance, but that's not the point of the movie.
That's not the point of the movie. And the movie sets up the two characters, and I think in a pretty, you know, fairly intelligent way. Monica Barbaro has the romantic view that this is the least romantic night to have sex, and she actually would like to have it with somebody that she feels a connection to, which isn't unreasonable. And Callum Turner has a girlfriend and actually wanted to propose to her that night, but the girlfriend actually wanted to get busy with somebody who was a neighbor in the building. So Callum Turner is not feeling romantic, he's not feeling sexy, he's not feeling Randy, right? He's feeling brokenhearted, you know? And that's a good way to kind of set up these two characters. Like, they both have their reasons for not necessarily just fucking each other.
Right. Right, because why wouldn't they otherwise? But
yeah, because they're super hot. They're the most attractive people. I actually kind of like, did you notice that Callum Turner, every time a woman passes, like, in the, it's like a background joke that a woman is constantly turning her head and being like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Whenever Callum
Turner always passes. Looking at him. And I thought it was funny, too, that you see the photo of the guy who his fiance, played by Maya Hawke, was going to have sex with, and it's Glenn Powell.
Yeah, that's Glenn Powell, exactly.
And at one point, he's looking at an app for the night of sex, and he swipes past Sydney Sweeney. You know, there's some yeah, good stuff yeah. in here, and I got
there's some good cameos, yeah, Nicholas, right? I mean, really funny, playful
Nicholas
cameos.
Brendan, LeVar Burton. There's lots of funny. Who plays the rock star who she almost hooks up with?
Oh, I don't know. Is that somebody?
I don't think so, but he was very funny. And also, I think, is it Monica Barbaro? I thought it was Barbaro. Barbaro.
I would call her
every day if I could. Callum Turner was plenty charming in this, and has you know a body to drool over for sure. But Monica Barbaro, I mean, you know, first of all, you know, she gets your attention. And you know, and the movie barely dresses her. And even when she puts on a shirt, it like buttons one button. Like she is not afraid to show her off. And you know, this is the first thing I've seen her in where she's done sort of comedy. Like the only things I can remember her in are she was in the Top Gun Maverick.
Fair.
And then she got Oscar nominated for playing Joan Baez in the Bob Dylan biopic, but she was great in both of those things. But you know, here she really like carries the movie as the lead, and she's great,
and she's charming, she's witty, and she's sexy, and she's fun, and she's sweet, and she has a little pathos, and you care about her, and she's got the voice of an angel. I mean, it's total package. I mean, it's a very easy watch from that point.
Yeah, and to me, like, I don't understand all the bad mouthing of this movie because, like, that to me, that's a star turn. I mean, yes, the script is weird, corny, and the movie's a little overlong. But when you look at when you watch her, I'm like, this is a movie star, like I just think she's hot. I don't know, but I think she's really good.
She's actually really talented too. She's
and she can sing,
face,
and she can
know?
Sing, like and she can sing. And the songs are in the movie. Well, I mean,
the songs are well, hilarious. I mean, that conceit is worth it. I always feel like this movie for me is like not so much about the main story as it's about the peripheral
yeah.
story. You know, like the background jokes, the gags about her, like the running gag about her singing Big Pharma,
yeah.
like, knockoff
yeah.
covers to sell medicine to, you know, people with erectile dysfunction or with psoriasis. It's just hilarious.
Yeah, those are really fun. The songs are really funny. The whole big pharma ad and dance they do at the end, which I thought should have been the last scene of the movie. They, you know what I mean? That would have been just such a great ironic cynical ending. But you know, here's the thing. Like, I was dreading this film, Stephen, because the trailer, which played in front of everything I saw this summer, was dreadful. Dreadful. And the movie is 10 times as good as the trailer. Much better.
Well, it's wittier. It's more fun. I have to say, though, the trailer had me because I was like, Monica Barbaro, if you want to say that. Sure. Let's call her Barbaro. Monica Barbaro in a romantic comedy in there, in that dress. Absolutely. No problem.
Sure. And I, you know, my wife just kept rolling her eyes. I was like, all right, I gotta wait to see it. But again, it's not a great movie, but it has a thing. And I feel like with better marketing, it could have been a much bigger hit than it was. It was kind of a dud at the box office.
Also, it's like, it's a great August movie. It's also like, you know, I think there is a, you know, let's have low expectations for some movies. Yeah. This was not trying to be anything more than a fun romp with some really hot leads talking about sex. You know, let's do it. And we'll have some funny sight gags and we'll have some funny double entendre.
I thought it worked. Less successful was our other August movie that we're going to discuss today. That is called The End of Oak Street, which I reviewed for Book and Film Globe, and I feel like I liked it a little more than Stephen did, but I'm not. I really went, to me, like, The End of Oak Street is like, it's something you would have found at the back, on the back shelves of Video Roundup in 1982. You know, and it's set in 1980, and it feels like a bad B movie from 1982. And I know that's kind of deliberate on the part of the director. David Mitchell, is that right? Is his name? Or
yeah, it's David Robert Mitchell. I have to say, if I have an issue with your review, it's that you say the film is set in 1980, but there's literally a character. They ask at the end, what year is it? And a character says, it is 1982.
No, it's 1982 at the end when they flash forward 2 years, I think.
No. It's a couple years after that. No, she's brought, they're brought back, and then she orders the pizza, remember? Okay. And then it's a few years after that.
All right, so whatever. Sure.
Gotta call Dan and have him revise.
I'll get into the CMS and I'll make the change myself. The point is, it's a bargain basement 1980s action movie about a suburban Michigan neighborhood that is transported through some sort of cosmic anomaly into the Triassic period, and these 2 mile area of suburban Michigan is beset upon by prehistoric monsters.
Wait, so what is the difference between the Jurassic period and the Triassic period?
The Triassic period, if you look at the dinosaurs that were in the movie, the stegosauruses, the kind of furry bird monsters, that was those were all sort of in the first stages of evolving into mammals. Triassic was just a more sort of ecologically varied period of dinosaurs. So I'm just going to say Triassic, even though I don't know if an 80-foot long sea snake was part of the Triassic.
Albino sea snake. Wait a minute, that super rich librarian said it was 200 million years ago, potentially, right?
Yeah, potentially. You know, it went extinct 200 million years ago. It was the librarian who lived in a mansion on the edge of town. Yeah,
that's
so...
Right.
This movie is crap. This is bargain basement crap. But you know, it's bargain basement crap that surprisingly stars Anne Hathaway.
Right. Yeah. It's got some A-list. I mean, it's got Ewan McGregor. These are actors acting. Yeah.
Well, Ewan McGregor to me felt like his lines were being dubbed in, like he was speaking in the original German or something. I mean, he was so stiff. His character was so stupid and so useless.
Hey, man, he got laid off. He's delivering pizzas and he drinks a little because he's feels like a broken man. Real, that's his character.
Real in-depth screenwriting there. You know, Anne Hathaway, to me, like, I felt like she was channeling, like, the sort of action ladies in trouble of 80s movies. You know, Jo Beth Williams and Poltergeist.
Yeah,
Little Sigourney Weaver, little Linda Hamilton, but less competent.
Right. I mean, you know, I made a stink about the 1982, and I think that's just because that was the apex of Steven Spielberg's, like, suburban, you know, sci-fi fantasy nightmare visions of the world, right? Because that was E.T. and I think also
Poltergeist. Yeah, same era, yeah.
Which he, you know, respectively directed and then also produced and maybe ghost directed, right? Depending on how much credit you give Toby Hooper. But, Robert Mitchell he's a pastiche director. You know, he's a talented guy. He's made four movies. The Myth of the American Sleepover, I think is what it was called. And it was kind of like John Hughes, but refracted through like a kind of French New Wave sensibility. And then you had It Follows, which is very John Carpenter. And then you had Under the Silver Lake, which was very overtly referencing and homaging filmmakers like Hitchcock or Douglas Sirk or, you know, like, you know, actresses like Marilyn Monroe and Janet Gaynor. Like, it was a very Hollywood-y movie set in Hollywood. And it was a little onanistic, and it was overlong, and it was kind of too into itself. So, and this is his Spielberg movie. Like, I'm going to make a movie set in 1982 where a lot of, you know, it's a suburban family with, you know, divorce vibes and kids who ride bikes and are menaced by bullies. And then also they're dinosaurs, because that's what Spielberg does too.
There's lot of dinosaurs. You know, my complaint is that there's too many dinosaurs. Like, I mean, okay, it's a 2-mile area, and I know they land in the middle of prehistoric America, but like, I mean...
Full of dinosaurs.
I mean, full.
All the dinosaurs. Like, all the dinosaurs.
Hundreds of dinosaurs. And it's just like, what was that movie? Hundreds of Beavers. I felt like it was like I was watching 100. They're being... and you know, it's just too many dinosaurs. And so it to me, that removed some of the fun and the mystery of it. And also, like, the children's performances, particularly the 13-year-old boy. I thought Maisie Stella, who played the teenage daughter, she was okay, but like, the 13-year-old boy, he was so bad, and like,
he was pretty bad.
He was bad.
And he honestly thinks that a bow and arrow will stop a T-Rex, which is just nonsense.
He's just a wiener. He's just such a wiener. And the movie gives him no redeeming qualities. And it's just like, he, watching this wiener, I just wanted him to get eaten so bad.
I just felt like everything was so overwrought. The family dynamics were overwrought, you know, Anne Hathaway's, you know, like, you know, I don't know, her frustrated aspirations.
To be a novelist.
And she's typing away in the basement, you know, and, you know, the husband is unhappy, but they're unhappy. You know, like, I just, and then dinosaurs get thrown in the mix, and then there's no real good explanation of why that happens. And at the end, there's a sort of Back to the Future, what timestamp is it, and how can we, you know, make everything right. And it sticks the landing, I guess, to a certain extent. But it feels very J.J. Abrams in terms of like, don't worry about it. Let's just make a lot of weird mysteries that get the audience excited, and we don't really have to pay anything off. There's a certain condescension, I think, to the audience, which is annoying to me.
I just think there's a certain half-assedness. Like, it's amazing. I can only imagine what the first cut of this looked like.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, the pacing is all over the place. Yeah. The tone is all over the place. Yeah. I don't know if you felt that way, but I was like, what is happening? Anne Hathaway takes a Polaroid of her husband, you know, while, you know, with dinosaurs. Humping dinosaurs in the background. They're like rutting behind him. Like, what? It was just so weird. Like, what are you doing? Why aren't you more concerned about finding your kids? Like, every so often they'd be like, oh, but I love our kids. We have to find them. And you're just like, dude, they've been gone for like, you know, 40 minutes. Go find your kids. I don't know. It was just very weird. The whole setup was weird. You know, like, the whole neighborhood was suddenly empty of everyone, which was weird.
Right. And then
they all get eaten by dinosaurs immediately.
But then they started, people did start gradually showing up again.
Like the town bully, which is like, what? Seriously, that dude? Yeah. And then, like, the weird, like, the exchange student or the private school student, like, what the hell was that deal?
Yeah, that was some, like, weird some weird lesbian plot line that showed up
there. A weird lesbian plot line that wasn't a plot, like, a lesbian, but it wasn't. I was like, come on, guys. Come on.
I got two words for you, Steven. August movie.
August movie. It's yep, these are the dog days.
You know, soon enough.
Shaggy dogs. Shaggy dogs.
Soon enough, we'll be you know, talking about quality films again, and we won't be watching.
Who knows?
Dinosaurs chase Anne Hathaway around the suburbs.
Silly. And some of those dinosaur fights were so dumb.
Dumb.
Incidentally, August gets a bad rap. You know, Weapons came out last year in August, which was fantastic.
Right.
It was weird.
But it's
it was a weird Shaggy Dog, which actually was like thoroughbred.
Weapons is like the great August movie.
Yeah.
You know,
good, it's good.
Yeah, but it was an August movie. These are not great August movies. One Night Only is a relatively successful August movie, and it is to me the movie that made Monica Barbaro the greatest star. I know. Look at us. We're such like horny middle-aged men.
It's pretty pathetic.
But she is beautiful. She just is. And she really carries that thing. And, you know, I'd watch her get chased around by dinosaurs for 2 hours.
Look, I think if there's anything about August will give you movies. Probably, I don't know when The Meg came out. I feel like The Meg came out in August. Like, August is for movies where you want a rom-com with hot people. Here it is. Do you want a movie with dinosaurs that's kind of funny and has a sense of humor about itself? Here it is. You
know? Right.
Like, next week is Mutiny, which is Jason Statham, you know, basically in a boat. It's Die Hard on a boat.
Right.
But with Jason Statham.
It's August, baby. All right. Well, you have a good vacation out there wherever you are. My time here is done. I'm going to go not have sex with dinosaurs.
All right. I'm going to throw some steaks on the grill and enjoy the summer.
Yeah, it's August. You should. Okay. I've got to say, one of my favorite movies of 2026. I'm very surprised that this is one of my favorite movies of 2026. It's called Pony. And it is a sort of coming-of-age biopic about Anthony Bourdain, the late celebrity chef and author Anthony Bourdain. And boy, it was a delightful film from beginning to end. And Laura Pruden, Book and Film Globe contributor, wrote about Tony for BFG, and she's here today to talk to me about it. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Neil. So nice to hear your voice. Hello, hello.
Always a pleasure. So, this movie. You know, I know it's about food, so I'll just say it left a good taste in my mouth. It was delicious lobster roll. it was totally perfect, I thought, from beginning to end.
No, I thought it was, it's sort of, oh God, can I use the word romp?
Sure.
You know, it sort of is. I think it does a very good job of capturing summer and that sort of late teen age, those late teen years, and 1975, you know. And it really is this you're on the edge of something. You're on the edge of the world out there in Cape Cod, on the edge of the future, and also the sort of the way we all kind of blew it. I mean, I did in our teens.
When we were that age. When we were that age. Yeah. The random bus trips to see someone, the career aspirations that had no chance of succeeding at the time, you know, your desire to be an adult and to have adult relationships and an adult career, but not having any of the skills or infrastructure, make that happen,
and
or money.
And also this kind of amazing opportunity in a way to invent yourself, which, like, I think of, you know, summer camp. Like, you can go away. No one knows you, you know. And I think then there's this wrinkle in Tony where someone does know him. It's the person he's pursuing, but he's also putting on, I mean, it's more complicated than that. But I thought it was really good. I think that the pacing of the film is excellent. I felt like a couple things could be fleshed out maybe a little more. Yes. I think
the female lead.
The female lead, yeah. I was put in mind of like Dazed and Confused. And yes. I thought like Linklater really, really fleshed out every character. I mean, it was amazing. People would have four lines and you remember them. And I think this film didn't do that.
This film basically was to me, it was like, well, first of all, the biopic is that Anthony Bourdain is a student at Vassar who thinks he's going to get this creative writing fellowship that he has no chance of actually getting.
Right.
Doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. And then follows a girl to Cape Cod for the summer, essentially.
Right. Right. Lying that he's there for the fellowship.
And ends up working in a restaurant run by Antonio Banderas, like a fast food seafood restaurant run by Antonio Banderas.
Like a cheap and cheerful place. And we have to say, you know that if you read my review, you'll know this. I have to mention that Antonio Banderas is amazing in it. I think he's just fantastic.
Truly, truly fantastic. Like immersive. A complete performance. A performance that I think should probably get him some nominations.
It deserves it. It deservedly. I mean, he is so. On point. And you know what I love? I was reminded, I was like, oh God, this is why we fell in love with him. This is why we fell in love with him in like Mariachi, you know, is because he can, not even in close up, just in with the subtlest move, deliver, like communicate. His ability to communicate is just beyond and a delight. And he's funny. And it's a delight to watch him. Yeah.
And the other two main characters, Anthony Bourdain is played by Dominic Sessa, who was mm-hmm. we last saw playing opposite Paul Giamatti in The Holdovers. And I think he's in every scene.
Yes.
Every scene.
Yes.
And he carries every scene and he's believable.
Yeah. No, he does a great job. And I think that I think that is partly, I'm sure that he's a lovely actor, but I think also part of that is due to Matt Johnson, the director.
Yes. I want to talk about Matt Johnson because I don't know if you've seen Matt Johnson's other movies.
I have seen Nirvana, the band, the movie.
Which was to me the funniest. That's the funniest movie I've seen in years. I love that movie.
You know what? And it snuck up on me as I was watching because I hadn't watched the show, and I was like, okay, it's kind of doing like a little bit of a Spinal Tap. Is it reality? Is it not? And then
Little Wayne's World, Little Bill and Ted.
Yeah, exactly. A Little Bill and Ted, and it's sort of yeah, it's wonderful. You know what I liked about it too, which I think maybe. Now that I'm talking with you, I'm thinking maybe translating to Tony, is that there's like a self-awareness, mm-hmm. but there's not an apology. You know how sometimes when people do it with a wink, they're kind of like, oh, I know this is stupid, right?
No, it's humane.
And he doesn't do that at all.
It's very humane.
And it's very, and in that, in his other work, he even does like direct to audience, you know, sort of he'll look right at the audience, direct address, which doesn't happen in Tony. But I think he has like a little, he's got a joie de vivre, and that comes through in Tony and is appropriate.
I love Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, and I think totally there's some similarities, but the better comparison is his movie about the creation, the life and death of Blackberry.
Yes.
Which I don't know if you've seen that.
I have
but
not.
You got to watch it. That movie is terrific. Better than Tony in some ways, just because it's got more scope and more depth. And but that's the movie that got him this Tony directing.
I figured when I read about it, I was like, oh, that makes sense.
And now he's going to go mainstream. And apparently his next project is directing a trilogy about Magic the Gathering.
Oh, right. I read that. Well, I think I will say that I think that he – and I'm not the only one saying this, you know, that he seems to have made the transition to, quote, Hollywood movies pretty seamlessly. And even though this film has absolutely has a few recognizable faces, Leo Woodall is marvelous.
Yes,
I think marvelous in it.
Yes.
It isn't, it still feels very sort of small and intimate,
yes,
you know?
It is.
I will
it
say,
is.
You know, you mentioned the scope of Blackberry, and ultimately I think it was the right decision, but I was aware of the fact that I think Tony feels small in scope because it is very intentionally just this one chapter. And I think it really, it relies on our knowing what happened in his life, but it doesn't tell us that story. Even the end sort of notes that just say, like, he went on to culinary school. I'm not spoiling anything. We all know this. He went on to culinary school and then wrote a book. It also kind of stops short because we know how his life ended, which I actually found a little, like, it was a little heartbreaking watching Tony.
Well, right.
Because, for me. Because yeah, you see seeds of even where he went. Do you know? Like,
yeah.
He's passionate.
With the drugs.
Well, with the woman.
The woman, yeah.
You know?
His obsession over this
yeah.
woman. And in the end, we don't really know why he killed himself, but we suspect it was over tragic beauty.
Right.
And,
I mean, his relationship at the time was ending. And maybe we, of course, no one can ever know, but yeah. It was sort of like, wow, this is a man who his hormones are strong. The hormones are strong with him, you know?
Yeah. And I think he might have some.
Oh, no, but I mean, issues. I say hormones.
Addiction issues. Yeah.
Right, and hormones, like, that's a real chemical thing that can be an imbalance. I'm not being like, he's horny. I'm like, he's really, like, impacted by, you know, his body, his sort of chemistry is doing a lot, for sure.
I mean, it translates, it's a mental illness in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, he's a little too obsessed with this lovely, yeah. intelligent woman. It's not like
mm-hmm.
his taste is bad.
Mm-mm.
It's not like just
oh, no.
some random
she's
woman.
She's entirely appealing. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think
there were moments when she showed up where I was like, oh, yeah, I get it.
Well, and there are moments where Leo Woodall came on and I was like, no.
Yeah, well, same here. There were definitely moments where Leo Woodall showed up and I was like, yeah, I get it.
Right. You're like, oh, right. Oh, yes.
Well, that's the thing about this movie, Laura. It's sexy, right? Like,
oh,
you
it's
know,
totally
Dominic
sexy.
Dominic Sessa is attractive. You know, Antonio Banderas, always sexy.
Oh, please.
Leo Woodall, smoldering. And Amelia Jones, who plays the love interest, is you know, beautiful in it. And so it's like, it has sex appeal. It's got a lot of comedy.
And in that way, it's kind of following in the tradition, right, of so many summer teen movies, which
yeah.
of course it isn't, but like even going back to like Matt Dillon, like 100 million years ago, do you know what I mean? Like the sexy movie stars on the screen.
Yeah.
And it's
I
just
know,
interesting because
right?
like our lead isn't that. And that's part of his challenge at this point in his life. Right.
Yeah.
Is he's going to develop his charisma with age. And, you know, he's got like a patina to him as he goes forward, which makes him appealing in the same way that Antonio Banderas is.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting choice, like you said, to like not do the Kitchen Confidential years, not do the, you know, mm-hmm. they didn't take the Michael Jackson biopic treatment where you get 15 minutes of young Tony and then you have to watch him like, you know, gradually decline.
Well, no, right.
Soar and
no.
decline. You know, this wasn't the Amy Winehouse movie.
No, it wasn't. This was the inciting incident. This is the what do you call it? The origin tale, right?
The origin story.
And it's, thank you. I can't remember the word.
It's just beautifully done. It's just such a great movie. And, you know, I don't think, you know, it came out in August. It's getting a very limited indie release. I think it's one of those things where we're going to talk about this thing over coffee or if I ever get invited to a party again at parties and be like, okay, Tony. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, I didn't see that. I'm like, well, I think it's on Tubi. You can watch it on Tubi.
You know what, though? I have to say, Neil, I hope I hope not, because the cinematography is beautiful and Cape Cod is like stunning. And I think, and the cinematographer whose name is escaping me has done some really significant sort of sweeping work, and you can see it in this. I was like, oh, like it's, very, very beautifully shot.
Yeah. It's a top, it's really a top shelf film, and I'm glad I saw it. And, cause I was initially kind of reluctant. I was like, oh my God, no, please don't.
Yeah.
Please don't immerse me in, you know, Anthony Bourdain myth making. You know, his end was so pathetic.
Yeah.
And so terrible.
Tragic, yeah.
His legend is so over. There's so many young men who are trying to be him but have no chance.
Oh.
And you know what I mean? And but this movie's so good.
God, yeah, I agree with you. And it's funny because I've also heard the director has more than once sort of insisted it's not a biopic. And my response to that is like, I think he's using a narrow definition of biopic. And that maybe he wants to seem different, like he's, you know, not doing what everyone else does. Because honestly, I think it is a biopic, and I don't think a biopic has to be like recreating a person's life minute by minute, you know. But at the same time, I kind of hesitated to go see it because I was like, I don't know if I need to see a biopic about you know, Anthony Bourdain. And then it really isn't. It really is a snapshot. It's a chapter, and it is from a chapter in his book. Like, I think that, you know, we can sort of use that word. Like, it really is, it's a chapter, and he captures those moments in time. And I think it does tell a universal story in this specific. I think it does to a very large degree. And I'm not a cook, and I related to it.
I cook a little bit, but I mostly like to eat, and it was like and it did everything for cooking and food for me that the Bear did not. So I'm happy happy to have watched it.
Which tells me, Neil, you don't really like cooking, because honestly, there's not that much cooking, Tony. There really isn't.
There's a lot of implied cooking.
You know what I mean? Yeah, but it's not like it's.
There's also not that much sex, but it's still very sexy.
There you go. Oh my God!
All right, look, I nailed it.
You did.
That's the button.
Clearly,
yes.
We need to meet for lobster rolls in Cape Cod.
I will try to get a pass to do that.
I was gonna say we could do that. They'll send us there, right?
For the podcast.
Yeah.
For sure. And we'll get a dozen oysters, but they're not going to cost 50 cents each.
No, not anymore.
All right. Thank you, Laura.
It's good talking with you, Neil.
All right. Thank you so much, Laura Pruden. Tony is in theaters now. Definitely check it out. It's really great. And I can't recommend it more highly. I find it funny that I'm saying that, but it's true. Also in theaters now. Oh, you know, you should see every movie. These movies, I think, are worth seeing for one reason or another. One Night Only and The End of Oak Street. And Stephen Garrett was here to talk to me about these movies. And it is August, so just see whatever is available. And, you know, the grind of the fall will begin soon enough. Enjoy these waning days of summer. Get some sun. Get some air, get some sea, have a lobster roll, enjoy yourself. This is the Book and Film Globe podcast. Enjoy our theme music, which is originally composed by the great Matthew Sheffer, all rights reserved. I'm Neil Pollack. I am the host of the Book and Film Globe podcast, and I will talk to you. Mm-hmm.